Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 673.GN4910, certificate number 49596. Joanna Southcott's box.
Now, what's in the box?
Now.
What?
We'll get to her box in a moment. But for the moment, let's see.
Should we reveal our dark secret?
That we're redoing the first 20 minutes of this show.
Yeah, we just recorded this show for 20 great minutes. Really, the lost...
Top shelf omnibus.
The best omnibus you never will hear, because we recorded it for 20 minutes, and then my computer took a crash.
We revealed how all millennials will be able to afford a house.
We had the whole scheme. We told you where to invest your money. We saw into the future.
You can eat all the avocado toast you want.
And the thing is, I was really funny and interrupty, and I wouldn't let Ken get to the topic, but it was all like great stuff, and now I feel so chagrined and sad.
You know, there's a bunch of people who are like, the first 20 minutes is gone. They're going to get right to the story. This is perfect.
We might, actually.
Maybe we should do this every week. John, it didn't work again. We're going to have to cut that half hour.
Just burn off the first 20 minutes where I'm like, what? No. Ice skates. Rollerblades.
Well, let's see if you're any better this time, because the first time we did this, I asked you if you know, for a big, important $10,000 Daily Double, if you knew the first sentence of A Tale of Two Cities by Dickens.
And what happened?
You correctly said...
What is... It was the best of times, it was the worst of times.
Very good!
It was the hour of our despair, it was the night
of
our...
No. Oh. You didn't know that.
I did too know that.
Previous John was like...
I got about three quarters of the rest.
Oh, yeah, that's true. We did the rest of it. Yeah. So that's, even though we think of that as the iconic first line of the novel. In fact, it's a big run-on sentence where Dickens goes on forever. Not only, you know, there's a comma after times. Weird. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of...
Despair.
Foolishness.
Wisdom? I said despair last time.
Wisdom can't be the opposite of despair, can it?
Wisdom and foolishness. Okay.
It was the epic of belief. It was the epic of?
Ignorance.
I think you said faithlessness?
Faithlessness.
Incredulity.
Incredulity.
You're doing good, but Dickens had a thesaurus that you don't have. Let's keep doing this till you know the entire first paragraph of... It was the season of light. It was the season of...
Darkness.
Ding. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of...
Discontent.
No, it was
despair.
You were right last time. You're getting worse at this. We had everything before us. We had
nothing.
We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going
to the other place.
Exactly right. You thought it was going to be straight to hell, but you can't say that in 1857 or whatever this is. He said we were all going direct the other way.
Other way.
A whimsical way to say that, well, hell exists, but you can't say its name. In short, he says, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on being received for good or evil in the superlative degree of comparison only.
Oh, sure.
Which I think means...
Huh?
Even though it was just like our time and there was nothing special about it, they were super insistent that they were the special superlative people.
Which is funny, because in 1857, they definitely didn't think that they were the... superlative people.
Everyone thinks,
which of course they did.
Everyone thinks they're the pinnacle of history,
except for now, right? Have you ever? There's no time in history where people were as down on their contemporary time as we are. I mean, it's not down like there have been lots of people that said these are the end times for the last 5,000 years. This is the end of history. But we're just dragging on our time. We don't even think this isn't like even special enough to be the end times. It's just like.
It's just kind of lame.
It's just the lamest time.
Well, that is a superlative. I guess that would be that would be the Gen Z superlative. Like, we got the lamest run of luck because we live in the lamest time where we don't get a chance.
Even though this is clearly, by any statistical measurement, not the lamest time.
Right. Do you remember when it was like actually kind of trendy to say that, and you had a lot of, maybe it was like kind of a Bill Gates technocratic kind of an insight to point out that, hey, like worldwide, you know, famine's never been lower, and all these diseases are more under control than ever before, and
less starvation, less war, less violence against women, less everything, except
family planning and vaccinations now,
except more deaths by hurricane.
Yes.
But maybe not. Maybe the death rate is the same. It's just more cars are overturned.
more people have the good fortune of dying in their car.
Well, we have better inner tubes now than we did, say, 100 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, but there's also more places where you need to make sure you have an inner tube on your roof ready to go.
There it is.
Just in case.
I think the feeling now is that although these aren't the end times, we've set the clock running on the end times, so everybody now is very convinced that there's no pulling up, that we're in the middle of the crash.
And also that it's not even going to be a good crash. It's the idea of the banal dystopia,
right,
where things just gradually get more corporatized.
We just skid to death.
More crappy. Yeah. Skidding to death.
Skidding to death.
That's your kind of, that can be your Robert Bork slouching toward Gomorrah.
Yes.
Bestseller that I'm going to buy in a Christian bookstore.
Yeah, that's
someday.
Right. Slouching toward Bethlehem again. How many times do I have to hear that reference? It's like six times a day now.
Really, Yeats?
I feel like
Yeats would hate that he became one meme.
I know.
He was like, I wrote about the swans. I wrote about the lake.
What about the gyre? The gyre is everything. And it's like, no.
Well, I think the Falcon not hearing the Falconer is also everywhere now. Right.
Yep, like. Right.
But, yeah, I don't think Yeats meant now. He didn't mean 2024.
You know, it's funny. Two months ago. Who knows? Time is a flat circle.
Longer ago than you think, probably.
But for whatever reason, I read some garbled reference to the Falcon.
The widening gyre, etc.
And I sat, it was middle of the night. I pulled up my phone and I read the Second Coming out loud in my most ASMR, like bedtime story, close mic, long pause voice.
And then you put it on your Patreon.
And I was like, I should put this on my Patreon.
Oh, really?
I didn't know. I thought about it. I was like, this is the sexiest thing I've ever done.
Is read about the end of the world?
Read about the end of the world, particularly, in the Levant, right? It's very...
Oh, that's true.
It's ripped from the headlines. And it was so sexy that I couldn't do it. I was like, no.
This sexualizes Hezbollah too much.
Yeah, things fall apart. The center cannot hold. And it was just really like, whoa.
Were you doing it in some kind of like 900 number breathy voice?
A little bit. Things but, you know, apart. It was not call, that. I wasn't creepy
me.
About it. But it was, three in the morning. I had that 3 a.m. voice where I was like, I don't know.
John, I'm turning and turning in my widening gyre for you.
Ceremony of innocence is drowned.
If you read on.
Wait, in The Second Coming or in Dickens?
We're back to Dickens. Okay. Sorry. Sorry, Ireland. Yeats is over. The Yeats portion of this program is now over. Keats and Yeats is on your side, and Dickens is on mine. He goes on to land on what could only be described as extremely topical references, which we are unable to appreciate as such because, first of all, we don't get them, so they just sound confusing. But also, anything in a book from the 1850s is going to sound fusty and old-fashioned, and we're just going to be blinded to the fact that he's doing the equivalent of a of a late night monologue about, did you see what's in the news today?
Is he like jibing Benjamin Disraeli or something? Like, oh, Disraeli's pocket square was always askew.
Here's the puzzling sentence that's just like at the bottom of the, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times page, and it's probably been confusing high school students ever since. Mrs. Southcott had recently attained her 5 20th blessed birthday, mm-hmm. of whom a prophetic private in the lifeguards had heralded the sublime appearance by announcing that arrangements were made for the swallowing up of London and Westminster. So A Tale of Two Cities begins in 1775, and Dickens is trying to cast us back 75 years. Like, it would be like you and I writing about the 50s, I guess, and being like, Elvis had just been drafted, or...
he'd left the building. Well, no, he didn't leave the building until the 70s.
He's still 20 years away from leaving the building. But it would be more like, you know, you were saying, like, Adlai Stevenson had just been nominated.
Right.
And Elvis...
And a private at the,
Elvis
at the door.
Elvis was in the army. Yeah.
Like, saluted heralding the coming end times?
Well, that's what's going on here. He's combining two things. One, apparently, there's some British Army private who announced in 1775 that London and Westminster were about to be swallowed up.
By the American Revolution?
That's correct. Right. Yeah. We never quite made the...
didn't swallow them up, but...
Remember Washington drawing up that invasion of the British Isles that never happened?
But
Operation Porpoise or whatever?
If swallowing up is a euphemism, maybe it's that we hurt their feelings.
No, we were about to swallow them up with all the, you know, centuries of cultural imperialism.
Oh,
You're going to want our blue jeans and our... Right. Our weird candy stores in Covent Garden.
Here comes Elvis, maybe 150 years later, but here he comes.
He's early. Well, he's kind of doing a little prophecy like that because he links this army guy's ripped from the headlines 1750 doomsday scenario with the 25th birthday of Mrs. Southcott. Hmm. And this is a reference that in 1859 was very timely because the late Joanna Southcott was then having a bit of a renaissance, even though she was dead.
Wait, Joanna Southcott is a real person
yes.
in this literary adaptation?
Not just in A Tale of Two Cities, but in real life. He is mentioning, this would be the equivalent of saying, and this was, if we were writing about the 50s, to be like, well, Julie Andrews had just turned 18 or whatever.
Now I'm really curious, how much of Dickens... does he refer to actual people living or dead?
I think quite a bit.
Yeah.
I think especially, I think we've discussed this on the show that Bleak House was based on, a case that current readers would have recognized, an endless legal battle over a will. And I think there's quite a bit of that. And then we just don't see it. And when we do see it, we're like, ah, what a funny old-timey thing to say that Mrs. Southcott had recently attained her 5 20th blessed birthday, and we can't hear it the way an audience then would have been, which is like, ooh, I get that joke.
Right, here we go.
I read that in the paper last week when I was in the coffee house.
Even more contemporary than an Adlai Stevenson reference.
if that such a thing could be possible.
Right.
And because it was kind of a thing that people would have been joking about. It would have been like, Jay Leno doing a Lance Ito joke in the 90s.
Yeah.
Or the equivalent today would be somebody who, did something funny on TikTok, It would be a very of-the-moment thing for the intelligentsia to laugh at, because Joanna Southcott was a prophetess, as implied by linking her to this end-of-the-world scenario. When she's 25 here, the time Dickens talking about, she is not yet a prophetess, but she is about to become... basically a forerunner of the late 19th century thing of women totally disempowered by their church and their power structure, declaring themselves to be their own spiritual authorities,
This is the birth of woo.
It is. It's the first New Age thing. It's spinsters who can talk to the dead and who know what God wants to tell you and therefore can reclaim a kind of power that they're not getting in any of the pews.
Listen,
Most
of the woo girls I know would be very mad at being described as spinsters.
Well, back then they were spinsters.
Oh, I suppose that's true. Now they're highly empowered lifestyle coaches and yoga instructors.
Until they get a baby and a man.
Well, no, that's not happening for most of the ones I know. And here's to them.
I do not want to
high five.
I did not mean to use spinster pejoratively, but back then that's how these Victorian women would have been discussed until they became celebrities because they have the amazing powers at their seances or whatever.
Right.
And
they can ring a bell behind a curtain It's your great grandfather.
It's very tricky to reach under a chair and knock a bit or ring a little bell. But a lot of those women from the end of the 19th century looked back to Joanna Southcott, who's kind of the great grandmother of that whole thing.
Huh.
The record is pretty quiet on Joanna Southcott. She was born in 1750 in Devonshire, where she went into service. She was a house servant in her 30s and into her 40s. But we first heard about her at the age of 42 in 1792. She finally does the thing that gets her into Dickens, which is she loses her damn mind.
Mm.
Or, conversely, God begins to speak through her.
Really hard to tell the people of Devonshire.
Back then, God is extremely busy. He's talking through a lot of different people on several continents, as we have noted on the show.
Now he's really contained. He's only talking to a very few people. A few Southern Baptists, a mullah or two.
You got Rome.
He's still got the
red phone to Rome.
You know, the big guy in Rome right now doesn't give the impression that God is talking on a daily with him, does he? He's more like, well, I was thinking about this.
You know what would be nice? Is a little different than Thus Saith the Lord.
Yeah, exactly.
And people liked Thus Saith the Lord.
They still do in certain quarters, right?
Yeah, people get mad that the Pope is like, you know what would be nice?
If you think about Episcopalians in Africa, they got tired of Episcopalians in America saying, wouldn't it be nice? And they're like, no, no.
According to you, man, it's basically, well, that's just your opinion, man.
That's just your opinion.
As a religious movement. Joanna Southcott's peers report behavior that now looks perhaps as much like paranoid schizophrenia as it, do we not say schizophrenia anymore? It looks like some kind of, looks like some kind of mental break. She begins reporting visions. She's hearing disembodied voices in her head. When she goes to bed in the servants' quarters at night, she dreams of fiery horsemen.
Hmm.
So she's apparently of an apocalyptic bent at 42.
This was, you've done several shows about the rise of apocalyptic sects.
Yeah.
Starting in the early 19th century, right? But this is a little early for that.
Yeah, she's ahead of her curve. She's even before the kind of the Great Awakening early American ones that often pop up on Omnibus,
right?
Because this is happening in the 1790s. Right around this time, unfortunately, she's putting up with the indignities that a lot of working class women would have at that time, namely a horny footman.
A horny footman?
We all hate. Every mansion house has one. That's what Downton Abbey has taught me.
Uh-huh.
And in the case of this house in Devonshire, the horny footman has been making advances to 42-year-old Joanna Southcott in dark candlelit corners.
Oh dear!
And she rejects them. She's a good God-fearing Church of England member,
right?
And
begone, horny footman!
Begone, horny footman! She says, "Thus saith the Lord."
Uh huh.
And unfortunately, he has heard the rumor circulating about her new religious awakenings, so he goes straight to Lord. Whoever.
Penobscot Bottom.
Lord Penobscot Bottom, and says, hey, you know the maid's crazy, right? She's telling everybody about a fiery horseman, and she hears talking in her head. And he leaves out, and she won't put out.
Right.
Which is his main issue. But the horny footman wins, as they so often do, and she is summarily fired. And this begins her prophetic career.
This is one of those, you got fired, but it ended up being great for your career.
It's a full-time job. She becomes an influencer, having lost her job. This is going to be a whole new chapter for her, John.
Yes, that's right.
She's not mad. She put on her Facebook that she's not mad at all.
Totally.
She begins her religious journey by stepping away from the Church of England into a crazy off-the-wall cult. She becomes a Wesleyan Methodist.
No.
So that's...
Oh, boy.
That's the first step down the ladder.
Sure, bang a tambourine.
But she's, unlike most Methodists in the pews, she's convinced that God is speaking specifically to her, and she begins writing down the word of God at length in a series of rhyming prophecies.
Rhyming?
Yeah, that does seem like the hard part, doesn't it?
I mean,
unless God's giving you the rhymes, unless God is like, Joanna, I would like to give you a secret. I shouldn't have chosen a word that doesn't rhyme with
secret
anything.
Secret doesn't rhyme with anything.
It's got to rhyme with something. I'll tell you a future both dangerous and piquant.
Do not worship the golden calf, otherwise I may not laugh. Says God.
I may not laugh, God. That famous quote.
Well, so it seems to me that lots of people over the course of several thousand years think that God was talking to them and they wrote it
down.
They
have to write it all down.
But if
not for them, we would not have any religious texts.
It's rhyme that's the nice... Although,
does the Quran rhyme? It doesn't, right?
No, but of course, all of the Greek legends all rhymed or kind of... They had meter.
They have meter at least. I don't know how much Homer rhymed.
But how much... how much is the Bible, how much is the Old Testament in Hebrew, if you could really put in...
Much of it, yeah. Much of it is full of poetic...
Yeah. If you find all the right vowels and stick it in there, maybe it has rhyming.
That's the thing about being able to choose your own vowels. You don't need a rhyming dictionary if you could just be like, what rhymes with cow? Oh, yeah. Throw.
Hmm.
She has terrible handwriting, so she requires the use of scribes. But luckily...
Were there tons of scribes in southwestern England at the time?
She winds up in London pretty soon.
Oh, lots of scribes.
And that's where she is able to find an audience because she's got an appealing... She's got at least an attention-grabbing message because sometime in the 1790s, God tells her, she says, I am ordered to put into print the woman in the 12th chapter of Revelation is myself.
Oh.
Whoa. A little twist at the end of the sentence.
Oh, Revelation's a dark text.
The 12th chapter of Revelation features two figures, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars, who is, by the way, travailing in birth.
Yeah.
She is pained to be delivered. So there's a
baby on the way.
A woman in the sky with a baby on the way. But then there's another wonder in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his heads. So she's got an enemy, a red dragon. And isn't that the worst when you're about to give birth? And suddenly...
Red dragon is a scary movie, too.
Giant red dragon. Yeah. Do you think that's what it is?
Maybe.
Do you think red dragon comes on her hospital TV?
No, I've never fully understood this. At what point in the Adam and Eve story, between Adam and Eve and Noah, when were there 5-headed red dragons? Because I don't remember... The Bible's kind of silent on that. It's kind of a long period.
Well, this being in Revelation, I think, is an apocalyptic prophecy. It's a prophecy of the end times.
Oh, the red dragon is yet to come.
Yes.
I see.
And I don't think it's actually like Smaug the dragon. Yeah. I don't think it's like House of Dragons dragon. I think it's Satan.
Oh, Satan in his many forms, in this case, a 5-headed dragon.
Yeah, because he's got a plan. The dragon stood before this woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. Wow.
Dark.
I mean, if I were her, I would maybe leave.
Well, now, hold up. If he's devouring the child, but we're at the end times, how is this at the end times? It's the beginning times. The baby's not even born yet.
Well, it's the beginning times for the baby. Generally, this is interpreted as a prophecy about the never-ending, until it ends, struggle between Jesus and Satan.
Oh.
So the woman with the suns and the moons about to give birth is the Virgin Mary. Satan is waiting to do battle with her son, but he's going to prevail. She brought forth a man-child who is to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne.
Now, hold on. I don't remember Jesus ever talking about a rod of iron as part of his plan. He's not like... Okay, and do unto others, and also look
also
out for
I'm
rod of iron.
I'm going to hit you with this big hard rod.
Yeah,
I think it might just be like a scepter, like it's a symbol of authority.
Oh,
I think I think the idea is that this woman's son is going to be a king. It's a royal figure.
But this is the thing: if you choose the carpenter's cup,
right?
If you choose wisely. It's a humble cup.
It's not a fancy rod.
No. So what? I don't remember Jesus having a rod. Oh, he had a staff, maybe. Like a crook, a shepherd's crook.
Yeah, he's metaphorically a shepherd. Yeah, but as you point out, by trade, a carpenter, he wouldn't know the first thing about being a shepherd.
Right.
He'd be like, no, I could fix your fence.
He lays down with the lamb.
No, the lion lays down with the lamb.
But isn't he the lion of Judah?
Well, I think maybe in Narnia, he's the lion. It's all very confusing.
Maybe that's Bob Marley.
Yeah. I always get these guys confused. See, this is a prophecy about the coming of Christ, but it's a prophecy about his second coming, when he will not be a wee babe in a manger with a humble cup and a nice carpenter shop waiting for him back at home in Nazareth. This is like
when he's a fiery baby.
This is kingly, I'm going to kill the dragon this time.
But he's still getting borned by a mom? When Jesus comes back, does he come back again as a baby?
Poetry is complicated. Wow. Well, many people have thought so. Like, that's kind of what this story is about. You know, we imagine, and I think there's the book of Matthew to tell us he descends from the heavens and all nations will see him at once.
Right.
But that has not stopped a bunch of people from saying, I think Christ could come again in a more normal way. And also, what if it was me, the Reverend Sun Myung Moon?
I see.
You know, you've always got these people who are like, Christ is going to come again like he did before. And you guys better take notice this time and write me a check.
What if his name is Damien and he goes to a private school in a limousine?
No, that's the Red Dragon.
Oh, right.
So she says she is, in fact, she reinterprets the scripture as not being a Marian prophecy about the virgin mother of Jesus, but in fact about a different virgin herself.
So she's not pregnant. She's rejected the horny footman.
Yes.
But she is saying, I might be the crowned lady.
That's going to give birth to the child that will do battle with the evil dragon.
Okay.
And when she heads to London, it is easy to find an audience for Catchy and scribes, since you seem worried about the logistics of it.
I was a little.
The kind of the employment angle here.
Yeah.
By the Catchy prophecies that she's producing. And she has a moneymaker too. She can pay scribes because she's realized that she can write down on a piece of paper, she can make her own paper seals and say, and write down kind of a melange of scriptural text. She'll write down the sealed of the Lord, the elect and precious, man's redemption to inherit. It's a bullet list, basically. It's a PowerPoint. The tree of life, to be made heirs of God and joint heirs with Jesus Christ.
I feel like I've seen this written on a piece of cardboard.
I've seen it on
being held
a
by
homeless
someone,
person at an on-ramp?
By the stoplight.
I think I've seen it in a chick tract.
Huh.
It's a series of the New Testament references that are not meant to appear together, but she puts them together and then will write your name on the back and give you this seal and then say, good news, you are now one of the saved 144,000 from the book of Revelation who can enter Christ's kingdom.
So this is like this is a Calvinist predestination story. She's able to pick the ones, the elect.
I guess, or God has picked, and she's able to. And if you pay 12 shillings, 12 guineas would be a lot. Oh, somewhere between 12 shillings to a guinea. I see. At the cost of that, apparently, that reminds God that you were always in His divine will to save,
And you wouldn't want it. You wouldn't have been there to give her the shilling.
It's a retroactive thing where your picture, your Back to the Future photo of you in heaven will retroactively disappear.
Right.
If you decide not to give her 12 shillings to a guinea. Maybe the other few shillings are a tip. It's not clear.
So was each one of these little scrolls custom made or to communicate to you directly? Is this like your
invitation?
The
message is the same. The only thing different is your name on the back. So it's more like a invitation to a baby shower.
Oh, I see.
Where it says the pleasure of your company is requested at the pearly gates, and then it has your name.
You don't get your special mantra where a monk whispers it in your ear.
She's not personalizing that for you. But
so
I guess,
is this like a gender reveal party?
If the gender were your eternal destination.
Okay.
It's an eternal destination reveal party.
Okay.
And also, she didn't give out ones where you would open them up and they say, nope, sorry, you're going to hell. Thanks for the 12 shillings. Like these were...
That would have been a good gag.
Can you imagine?
She'd be even more famous now.
Like maybe, what's the right ratio? Like, do you think you do 1 in 6, the bad one? Is that what maximizes profit?
Wow.
So she's doing okay. She's making a guinea every time she writes out one of these. And apparently, she's not beautiful or charismatic in any way. I mean, she's a 40-something servant girl from Devon who's had a tough life, and that's commented on as her profile gets raised. You know, the newspapers will say, she is a coarse, commonplace woman of considerable corpulency.
Oh, dear.
Not cool. Fat shaming in the pages of the Times.
Well, you know, it's so funny that newspapers almost... I'm still reading newspaper articles where it's like, she was an attractive woman. It's like, she's a senator. What are you talking about?
No, it's weird how nobody's ever like, Rand Paul enters the room with a gleam in his boyish eye and a
sachet. He's such a handsome young man.
His broad shoulders swaying from side to side as he entered the chamber.
But so the newspapers are commenting that she's not a comely lass.
Yes, she's not the kind of prophetess they were hoping to spend time with. But it doesn't appear to matter. Like, the newspapers appear to be railing in vain against her new popularity. People love her prophecies. By 1810, she's got 100,000 followers in London, including no less than Lord Byron. Like, celebrities are like, ooh, she's the new hotness. I've been to see Miss Southcott.
Well, Benjamin Disraeli does figure into this story. He would have been all up in
there. Maybe politicians were. Well, he's Jewish.
Oh, right.
What is he going to think about?
Probably not showing Christian up. Prophecy. At least people are talking about it in the office.
And she appears to be sincere. There's no sense that she's a charlatan. She's been reporting these visions, troubling visions, long before she had a following. So,
as William James has told us many times, or maybe just once, but it was a long time ago, and we've read it many times. The varieties of religious experience bring shine a light on the fact that the real crazy ones really are sincere.
Yes, right?
The true prophets are always...
If you've got a plan, you're going to be careful. You're going to be like, yeah, I can knock on the other side of a table. I'll just do a series of those for several decades.
Yeah.
But when you're like, oh, by the way, I'm the woman in Revelation chapter 12, because it gets better after that. The plot twist is that in 1814, now a 64-year-old virgin, apparently, Joanna Southcott announces that she is pregnant.
How old is she?
64.
Now,
will you still need her? Will you still feed her?
We started here in Tale of Two Cities, but now we have leapfrogged the French Revolution. Was there
Are you bummed that there was no more French Revolution in this story?
I was just like, when do we get to talk about the French Revolution? It's not part of it.
Oh, I shouldn't have led you on with a Tale of Two Cities.
Oh, right.
I could see that gleam in your eye. Like,
it's like,
I've got French Revolution things to say. Should we take just 30 seconds now and leave Joanna Southcott aside and let you talk about the French Revolution?
No, because we're like, Bonaparte is already like
right
part of the story. Like, let's just move on. She's pregnant, 64 years old.
By the way, before we get back to that, somebody wrote in to ask how your mom is dealing with Napoleon's new popularity, the Ridley Scott movie.
She wants nothing to do with it.
She's not going to go see Ridley Scott's Napoleon.
No. And in fact, I have suggested several times, like, hey, let's go see Napoleon. And everybody just scowls at me. So, well, apparently it's...
I think that's kind of America's opinion of that movie. That may not be particular to your mom.
Oh, I mean...
We're just...
Have you seen it?
No.
You don't want to see it?
I mean, it's a Ridley Scott movie.
Right.
I'm tempted.
What is it?
I saw like 50 movies in the theater last year, I think.
Are you afraid that there's a five-headed dragon in it and that's not, that there's like some dragon comes
that
out?
That would really be an underreported part of the of the Napoleon
I don't
story.
Read the trades.
Yeah. Okay, put on your 3D glasses now, folks. Here comes the dragon.
It's like a sex story. That's what it is, right?
It's
about,
yeah,
Josephine.
Josephine's not into him, but boy, is he a horny footman.
So do we have, but there's no like huge set pieces where a million Frenchmen invade Russia in winter?
I think so. I think there's computer-generated Frenchmen.
That's not the same.
All up in there. Going back to 1814, Napoleon's now... Wait, where is Napoleon 1814? Not yet in... Is he in exile?
He's in Huelva.
I feel like we should know this.
Yeah, we definitely should, and I think he is
not going to come out in this story.
He's in France. He's fighting. He's still fighting in 1814.
He's fighting the War of the Sixth Coalition.
Yeah, he's not, he's like...
he's doing great.
Yeah, he has not been to Elba.
So things are going great for Napoleon and for Joanna Southcott, who, congrats, is pregnant at 64 years old, not just with any baby, but she announces with Shiloh. Now, in Genesis chapter 49, there's a prophecy about a figure named Shiloh, the bringer of peace, mm-hmm, who will come to Israel. And this is taken by Jews as a messianic prophecy. It's taken by Christians as a Christian prophecy. But Joanna says, no, Shiloh is different than Jesus because I'm about to bear him. It's also, isn't that your song, by the way? Shiloh, isn't that the Shiloh when I was young? Didn't she do Neil Diamond in the Last Waltz? Or did you not?
I
do
did,
that?
But it's not. But it's not Shia.
Oh, you did. Dry your eyes.
Dry your eyes. Doesn't Take he, your song out.
Doesn't he do both in the movie?
It's a new. No, he just has Shiloh the one.
When I was young,
he comes. He does his tune, and they kick him out because he's not.
Robbie's like, hey, let him do Shiloh, and they're like, no. When
might have actually done it at the show, but he didn't. It's not in the movie, as far as I know.
I can't remember how old that song is. 67. So it could be. So she announces that this Shiloh is going to be the second coming. I guess it is Jesus. It's the second coming of Christ, coming again, not from the sky, but from a uterus, the old-fashioned way. And she submits to a series of medical inspections, in fact. And
is she visibly pregnant?
She does appear to have the signs of pregnancy. There's some kind of, I mean, I guess the papers have already been making fun of her considerable corpulency.
Yeah.
Okay. So maybe it's hard to tell, but she submits, I think, to 9 doctors, six of whom attest.
I've submitted to 9 doctors, and let me tell you.
6 of whom attest that she is, in fact, pregnant. And the popular press that that likes to make fun of Mrs. Southcott in kind of misogynistic ways immediately goes into overdrive, producing a series of saucy postcards of her revealing, you know, Joanna Southcott's box to some, you know, lifting up her petticoats to reveal Joanna Southcott's box to a...
What box?
Well, in this case... her birth canal to a series of doctors.
They're calling it a box?
No, we would call it a box. That's not the titular box.
Okay. I was like, what? Say what?
You feel like that would be anachronistic?
Well, I just didn't realize that it, you know.
It seems like an obvious, you don't think like box could have been used anatomically in, say, like by James Joyce?
It seems like something
My dear, that I wish to see
Lebowski
your
Lebowski would say. Not quite something, but you know, James Joyce, of course, also it is inspired by Satan.
Right. Like the Big Lebowski. Satan's greatest work was producing Ulysses and the Big Lebowski.
Listen, we're already pretty down on the Irish on this episode.
Oh, it's
Let's
true.
Let's leave them alone.
No, wait, did that happen in They're this version gentle. Of the show? Did we talk about Yeats or did we not?
Oh, we didn't.
I think we didn't.
I didn't do my whole.
You had a whole spiel about Yeats.
I did.
And now you don't. Now we have a Mulligan with the Irish, as it were. We can say whatever we want because they didn't hear what we were saying about Yeats.
I mean, should we leave that in the un? Should I not do my sexy nighttime reading of the second coming?
Let's do a small snippet with no context. Here is John sexily reading The Second Coming by Yeats.
Turning and turning in the widening gyre. The falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Thank you.
Very good.
If you want to hear the whole thing, go to my Patreon.
I thought it was going to be more like turning and turning in my widening gyre.
No, I'm not a creep.
Like a 900 number.
No, the sexiness of it is in the seriousness of it.
I see. If you get turned on by a looming apocalypse in the Middle East.
Yes.
This is the poem for you.
As read by a paternalistic North American.
Perfect. Yeah. That's what I want. So it's widely accepted that the 64-year-old is going to miraculously give birth. Unfortunately, her due date comes and goes in October 1814. Her followers are forced to announce that the baby was born... metaphorically and ascended to heaven.
Oh, sure.
Okay. This is what we saw. Do you remember the entry about the Chicago flying saucer people?
Yeah.
Because we talked a lot about failed prophecies there. And this is always one of the Kubler-Ross steps of a failed prophecy is it totally did happen.
It did.
Metaphorically.
Happen. Sure.
So she did give birth and the baby was ascended. And maybe this is what she told her followers. Good news. Shiloh was born and is now ascended to heaven, and the wheels are in motion.
And also beat up a 5-headed dragon on the way with an iron rod.
It does seem like a problem if you're going to predict the second coming of Jesus to have him immediately leave.
Yeah. Where's all the fire and brimstone?
He left minutes later. I know that's not what you were expecting, but if you give it a moment's thought, I think you will find that this is a good second coming.
Maybe you can clear this up for me. Jesus shows up, right? Second coming.
Uh-huh.
But second coming's bad because it's because there's like a, it's bad.
It's
on
bad
Earth.
For you because you're one of the wicked.
Well, yes, but it's but
the chosen are like.
But Jesus is still a righteous dude, right? It's not Jesus that's like walking around whacking people with an iron rod.
No, in fact, he's going to use the iron rod on the red dragon.
Oh, right, okay.
You know, so things will get briefly worse, but then in a final battle between the forces of good and the forces of the dragon.
But those of us who have not accepted the way, the truth, and the light.
Oh, no, you're
things
host.
End bad for us, right? But where's Jesus? He's not standing around, right? Watching us fall into a pit of fire.
He judges all mankind, I believe.
Wow.
So he's there.
The man himself. It's not just like a paperwork thing.
For you, it's a paperwork?
Well, you know, like just
hologram?
Well,
Jesus is hosting.
It's like you walk up
the final judgment this year?
You pay your guinea and you open up the thing and it's like, oh, sorry. And you fall through a hole in the floor like in Willy Wonka.
you think it's cardboard Jesus?
Well, like
no, he is there like the real Willy Wonka, wow. Watching all five of you or four of the five, fall in the chocolate river or whatever.
It's true.
But here's the thing:
Wonka doesn't really shed a tear for any of those kids.
Well, he doesn't because they were all bad. They were gluttons or greedy or they chewed gum. The three bad sins.
Is Wonka a Jesus metaphor?
He is in fact a Christ figure.
I did not. I don't know.
I'm thinking about that now.
Pretty good, though.
Well, he's brought a series of people to a wonderful place, a wonderful garden where they can frolic.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
they keep doing it wrong. He's like, don't go in the chocolate river, which is the forbidden fruit.
But Jesus never said that. Jesus never talked about any forbidden fruit.
Well, God and Jesus are one.
Oh, right.
I can't believe we have to go back to this remedial.
And that whole thing where Jesus walks out with a cane and then he like does a somersault and then he can walk fine. That's a great scene in
like,
the Bible.
You know when Gene Wilder walks out on the chocolate river as if it's solid?
Uh-huh.
Oh, no, wait. That's Peter Sellers at the end of being there. I get off-putting 70s comedians confused so often.
Wait a minute. Peter Sellers and Gene Wilder, you're putting them together in a category of off-putting comedians?
It's the one thing they have in common. Off-putting 70s comedians.
I guess he's... I showed my daughter...
Except I think Gene Wilder was nice in real life, and I think Peter Sellers
was awful.
Awful in real life, yeah.
I showed her The Producers the other day, and I had to do some explaining as it went by.
Hitler dad.
But that's right. But yeah, watching Gene Wilder and going like, oh, right, a little off-putting. Beloved.
He needs a Richard Pryor to be the yang to his yin, I guess. So yeah, I think you're right about Willy Wonka because then, you know, people act badly. Well, one of them acts good, but the ones who act badly, Wonka just shrugs and is like, look, I gave you this beautiful chocolate factory. If your own vices condemn you, and I think that's the Christian take on final judgment. Hey, you know, you had your chance. You had a beautiful chocolate factory. Get it together.
Well, so if you drink the bubble water and you fly up and almost die in the...
There is repentance.
Right.
Remember,
because
Charlie
come,
and Grandpa Joe do have a moment of weakness.
He comes and he gives the everlasting gobstopper that he stole for frankincense or for Quibbly.
Slugwort. Is that right?
Yeah, Slugworth.
Slugworth.
No, but Slugworth is from
Harry
Potter. No, that's Steerforth is a Dickens character.
But now I think Slugworth is from Harry Potter. Is it Slugworth?
Slugworth.
They actually use... We should do this for 20 more minutes. This is gold.
I can't believe we lost the good episode and we're replacing it with this.
There's an amazing episode where we talk about Yeats and AC/DC. And now we're just going to say Slugworth? For 20 minutes.
I can't wait to go on online and find all of the thesis papers comparing Willy Wonka to Christ.
But he's a satanic figure too when he goes into the boat, you know.
Yeah, right. Well, doesn't like, Jesus ever trip Jesus, everybody out?
Jesus goes into a boat, but he trips them out in a nice way. He's like, there's a storm, but if you hold my hand, it'll be okay. Wonka takes you in a boat and he's like, here's some LSD, kids.
So there's never dark Jesus. Jesus never goes through a phase where he overturns all the moneylenders' tables. That couldn't have been nice for the moneylenders.
One bad day. But hey, who cares about the moneylenders, John?
Well, that's a contemporary take.
Is it compatible with Marxism to be like, oh, the poor moneylenders, can Jesus just dial it back a bit?
Those landlords, boo.
So she's not pregnant, it turns out, or at least... The baby, Shiloh, does not appear. And what's even sadder for her legions of followers is that this all happened in October, and Joanna is dead by Christmas.
Oh.
Perhaps a result of whatever ailment made her appear pregnant, you know, whatever,
yeah, right.
Whatever the symptoms were.
Liver.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Giant spleen, splenetic tumor or something wipes her out by December. Her death date, I think, is officially given by as December 17th, but I think historians believe that she died on the 16th. Her followers sat around for a day or two, fully expecting her to come back to life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only once she started to smell a little less appetizing that they decided to bury her in St. John's Wood. You can go to Lord's Cricket Ground today and visit Joanna Southcott's grave.
Oh, and she has a grave. There's a stone.
She has a marker. Well, she had 100,000 followers, John.
Oh, wow, that many.
Yeah, you think Lord Byron's not going to give her a nice stone?
Right.
Now, but remember, this is only the beginning of the story because she has been writing down rhyming prophecies for decades.
Or at least scribes have.
Yeah, she has been writing down badly rhyming prophecies.
She's been rapping at scribes.
Her flow is amazing.
Yo-yo.
And at least some of these prophecies have been put into, we finally get to the titular box. They've been placed in a cask, a coffer, a chest of some description, and sealed up in this reinforced box. She gives them to a series of custodians. The first is a an early 19th century celebrity, a famous engraver named William Sharp, who, if you loved 1810s engraved versions of Benjamin West paintings, you would know, because he was the guy. Biographer, if you want to get a sense of him, biographers also agree that he's well made, but here's your double standard: well made, but given to corpulency.
Uh huh. But so, well made.
So if it's a guy, you're like, look at this stout gentleman.
Yes.
Or if it's a woman, you're like, look at this coarse, commonplace servant, harridan type.
Right.
Double standard. He is also described as a strong and expert swimmer.
Hmm.
So if you were worried, John, that Joanna's prophecies were to be given over to a poor swimmer,
right?
Fear not.
He could make it across the Chocolate River.
This guy did daily ablutions in the Thames. He is certainly going to cross to the other side, of the old River Jordan, the old Chocolate River Jordan.
Well, at least the other side of the River Thames. The Thames at that time would have been full of poop.
Yeah, the ablutions,
like the Ganges.
Yeah, exactly. They're called ablutions because you're like blue when you come out. The these prophecies in a mysterious box and then given to a surprisingly
strange receptor.
Good swimming engraver. Probably would have been forgotten today if not for Wu.
Okay.
Because as we have foreshadowed, we're just, maybe 50 years away from every woman in the British Isles deciding
that she's a medium.
She's going to start a cult. Yeah.
So what year did Joanna die?
1814.
1814?
Yes. Like fully, almost a century before the heyday of the of the rapping Edwardian seance giver.
Well, now I need to know what day in 1814?
I think I said she died. The Shiloh birth would have been October. I think she died December 17th or 16th, depending on how long they left her body out. Why? Is there a Napoleon resonance here?
Well, I mean, the Napoleon got to Elba in 1814, but in May.
He's already on Elba when she died.
But wait, he left Elba in 1815. So this is in this very brief period. She died and Napoleon is in exile, but yet to return.
A version of Omnibus where we constantly are interrupting the story to describe what Napoleon is doing elsewhere.
Where is Napoleon? It's not every Omnibus.
No, it's every Omnibus. Even if it's about the moon landing, we're like, and just to reiterate, Napoleon has been dead.
Still dead.
For 140 years.
Okay, so here we are. It's pretty early. It's 1814.
But if we fast forward to the late 19th century, in Victorian times, the reason why Dickens is writing about Joanna Southcott is because her memory never went away. She's considered kind of a fun curiosity. Here it's kind of probably an old-timey mention. It's like, hey, boomers, remember Ed Sullivan?
Right.
Remember Topo Gigio? Remember Howdy Doody?
Topo Gigio.
Topo Gigio is here. The ladies and gentlemen.
Senor Wenceslas.
Wenceslas?
Wences.
I was going to say the Beatles, but you're thinking of an alternate America where hundreds of millions of teens gather around the TV to watch
Hello.
Senor Wences.
Hello.
What does he say? What's
Senor
the theme?
Senor Wences.
I was going to say Sarait. Is that right? Sarait, Sarait. Sarait, Sarait.
Sarait.
And we only know because he was on The Muppet Show once. therefore letting Gen X know about this 110-year-old man.
Who was on...
Senor Wences.
Oh, he was... are you kidding? He was a popular figure.
See, here's the difference between early Gen X and late Gen X. You grew up in a world where there's still variety shows on, yeah. And Senor Wences is going to be talking to Donny Osmond or Barbara Mandrell.
100%. I know I saw him on the Carson show more than once.
I think this is a win for my side of Gen X.
I guess so.
Like, I think of Johnny Cash in jail. You think of Johnny Cash hanging out with... Goldie Hawn.
Are you telling me that you didn't draw little eyes and lips on your hand and talk to
it? I did, but only because he was on The Muppet Show.
Oh, I mean, we used to, I swear, we'd spend every other recess.
And here's the funny thing.
Hello.
My kids did it too.
Say what?
Because of me, my kids also know Senor Wences hand jokes.
They do, huh?
And I wonder if their kids will.
And your kids are thriving in contemporary culture. All of the other teens are like, what wags?
Well, I was thinking about this, you know, the fact that at the turn of the 20th century, we have this birth of woo, which means everybody is interested in ghosts and seances and haunted houses. And it's probably people growing up in that era with the memory of Houdini and stuff that give us the 20th century childhood of haunted houses and Scooby-Doos and, yeah. And creaking doors, like all the stuff that we kind of grew up with. That's a one generation received version of the Houdini era. There's creepy ghosts or charlatans pretending there's creepy ghosts behind every door. And I wonder if it's passed down, like do our kids think of that as a fun old timey trope? Maybe because of Disneyland.
Oh, sure. But there's so much like spooky culture that's just, that doesn't have that kind of fun, but maybe real.
You're right. They have the creepypasta kind of, what's the name of the skinny guy? I think it's called Skinny Guy. You go in the woods and you see Skinny Guy.
The Thin Man?
Slender Man. So you go in the woods and you see Skinny Guy. Like, yeah. That's not that. But there's also a strain of Gen Z that loves Tim Burton,
yeah.
Kind of jolly, whimsical hauntings. Are you doing the song from Disneyland?
Here comes Halloween.
Oh, here comes Halloween. I thought you were doing Grim Grinning Ghosts Come Out to Socialize. You just went to Disney.
Right down Santa Claus Lane. Yeah, did
your daughter like the Haunted Mansion?
The one across the street from Disneyland. The other one, Marriott's Great America. Oh, that's right.
Marriott's Great America.
California Adventure.
That's correct.
They had the ghost on the front gate going, it comes Halloween.
Right.
Ha, 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 ha.
Because at Halloween, it becomes Oogity Boogity's Midnight Spectacularium or something.
So one of the days we were there, they had a big party in the California Adventure where everybody came in costume.
But the problem is
at Halloween.
If you have tickets, they kick you out of the park
that day.
They
kicked us out.
Yeah.
But we could go over to the real Disneyland and see that.
You were like, so long, Marriott's Great America.
Yeah, but you know, my daughter got introduced to the Incredicoaster, and then all of a sudden she went from I'm terrified of roller coasters to I want to do it six times a day.
All she needed was a very thin Pixar overlay to convince her that roller coasters are good.
Well, it was funny because we stood at the gate and she was, not to put myself at risk of being yelled at by the entire internet.
It's Incredicoaster Dad.
But she was crying and like, I don't want to go. And I said, I'm never going to make you go on a thing, but let's look at the rest of, you know, this.
Look at all these kids.
Everybody's going on this and no one is
dying. So you're using peer pressure to persuade your children to do things they don't want to do.
Yeah, I definitely was. If you don't go on this ride, you will be forever not my daughter anymore.
Everyone in your class probably went on this ride.
No one is ever going to like you. No, I was just like, let's take a look at our environment. Then they would not build this to hurt you or to make you panic, or it is a manageable thing to overcome. And so with that, you know,
she settled down
and she thought about it and we waited in line and she was kind of hemming and hawing about it. And I was like, at any point you can pull the ripcord. And we got on it and then we got off and she was like, again. And now she talks about herself like, I'm a real roller coaster person. I know you are.
She's been on the Incredicoaster three times.
Disneyland was the thing.
Every time I go on the Incredicoaster, I think things are going to go according to plan, and then Jack-Jack escapes.
I know.
Every time you go, Jack-Jack escapes. I'm like, are we ever going to get to the press conference?
The amount of stapling on of the Incredibles onto that roller coaster
lame. It's because it was originally just a non-Incredibles-themed roller coaster.
Yeah.
It was called California Screamin', and it was just kind of a generic old-timey.
But they put weird speakers everywhere where it's
so you can hear the story.
Yeah, people are shouting at you, and it's like, this is not helping.
Here's my favorite bit that I do at Disneyland that my kids hate. I'm always complaining because every time I go on one of these rides, something goes wrong. Like Jack-Jack escapes or Stitch escapes. Like I'm all ready to just take a nice, quiet journey, and then suddenly we veer off course because something crazy happened.
Right.
All these rides should not be – they're not up to code.
Well, it's not like it's a small world after all, where things – it is. It That's continues to be a small world the entire time.
If they did It's a Small World today, it would be like, ah, now we're in the South Seas. Good thing – oh, no,
a tidal wave. It's not a small world.
Exactly. Why are we talking about Disneyland? Boy, oh, right.
Know. Are we still doing this show?
It was three steps away. Do you want to do your Yates thing again as a palate cleanser? I was talking about how like the – maybe the 1890s woo is like the woo for 20th century pop culture,
right?
But anyway,
it's an woo that's three woos removed,
right? Because it's an echo of you know, whatever our grandparents remembered from that time, you know, Houdini, filtered down through spooky radio shows, filtered down through Rod Serling, filtered down to us, and not just Rod Serling, but also, as we said, Scooby-Doo and the Hardy Boys. So Joanna Southcott, even though Dickens is remembering her in the 1850s, would probably be forgotten today if not for this particular outpost of British woo, the Panacea Society, founded in 1919 in Bedfordshire.
1919?
Yeah.
Fully 100 years later.
World War I is about to stop raging.
Where's Napoleon?
Napoleon is moldering in a...
in his tomb.
Tomb somewhere. That he's returned to France, right?
Yeah, oh yeah.
You can visit that.
You can.
Does your mom go?
Hitler did. So did Jim Morrison.
Where is it? Les Invalides or something? Uh-huh. I can't remember where Napoleon is. There is in Bedfordshire in the east of England a vicar's widow. I don't want to say spinster because in this case she's a vicar's widow.
Vicar's widow. Times have changed by 1919.
Named Mabel Bartrop. And like every British widow of this period.
She's named Mabel Bartrop.
She is of considerable corpulence.
Oh, sure.
No. She believes that God is speaking to her and she has powers to access the other side that do not belong to ordinary women and especially men. And again, this is the same phenomenon we're talking about with Joanna. These are women who have no power either in church or state or society. But if they create their own spiritual tradition, it doesn't matter if they can't be vicars like their beloved late husbands. They can run their own communities.
But this is 1919, so people aren't really buying the whole, like, your ancestors knocking on the underside of a table thing as much.
I think they still are. I mean, it's, you know, think of all the World War I dead, if nothing else.
Right.
I think there's a little after boom of, I want to hear the knocking and hear that Morris is all right. Her followers, I don't really know how this happens, her followers become convinced that she is Octavia, daughter of God, one of a series of prophets that have been promised. And they kind of imagine a lineage back to all these 19th century seers. Her deal appears to be, you're going to love this, homeopathy related.
Mm-hmm.
She says prayers over a piece of linen that then get distributed. You bathe the linen in water to make water A, which you can sponge yourself with.
Oh, yeah.
But then...
They'll give this to you in any German pharmacy.
You can predict this. Guess what you do with water A?
You don't drink it.
You have to dilute it further into water B.
Water B.
Which you can drink.
Yeah.
So you have both an external and an internal remedy for everything that ails you. And that's why they're the Panacea Society. They can cure everything with waters all the way from A to B, John, the full gamut of waters.
If you've got a head cold and you go to a pharmacy in Munster, they're going to give you water A and tell you to dilute it.
I need a bell to ring every time you make fun of German homeopathy.
Is it the bell of one of my fallen ancestors, World War
I
dead? Oh,
who's in the room, John?
Is it Yeats? Is he writing poems about World War I?
If you read, apparently... some kind of a woo-friendly woman in 1909 had written a new biography of Joanna Southcott called The Express. And Mabel Bartrop reads Joanna Southcott's biography and thinks, you know what?
I'm also pregnant with a five-headed dragon.
No, she believes, you're close. She believes this woman was the real deal. And what's more, I, Mabel Bartrop, am Shiloh. Like the second coming briefly happened and Shiloh was taken to heaven, but he was going to come back certainly. Or what kind of a second coming is that?
Right.
And now I know I'm him. I'm the second coming.
But what does Mabel say about her own mother? Was there any kind of manger involved or like how?
I think it must be, again, I think we must appeal to metaphor.
This Shiloh transference is fascinating.
Well, she briefly decides she's the second coming, but then this part's very funny. She decides she must actually be the third coming. Not, and you would think, oh, of course, because Joanna Southcott's angel baby was the second coming. No, I think what's very revealing is she feels that her late husband, the vicar, was in fact the second coming. And she has a very funny idea that she says, I always felt that there was something very mysterious about him. You know, in hindsight, years after his death, her sainted husband becomes... There was something ordained about our relationship. Not uncomfortably mysterious, but there was just something so right that I've now decided that he was, in fact, the second coming of Christ.
Something so strong. Wait, but he never claimed it.
No, of course not. He's just some country vicar in Bedfordshire. But it's kind of a Queen Victoria thing where she never quite gets over losing him young.
Oh, I see.
And decides that he must have...
He was Christ.
He must, in fact, have been Jesus. That's her. Here's an idea.
Did he have a lion body and the head of a man?
No.
Oh.
He was just a vicar.
Did he have a... Gaze blank and pitiless as the sun.
Here's a pitch for a kind of a pop song. It's you've lost your great lost love and have decided retroactively that they are our
he
Lord
was
and
Jesus
Savior.
But it's the not the whole time.
But it's not a gospel song.
Oh,
it's just like one of these Mooney girl group Leader of the Pack songs.
The leader of the
pack. And he was sure Jesus. Ooh ooh.
Wow. All the single ladies.
All the widowed ladies, put your hands in the air. She becomes fascinated by Joanna Southcott. And in fact, what's left of Cottian movement kind of filtered through other regional prophets who are like, you know, who was the real deal was Shiloh. The Southcottian, this movement has kind of held in the centuries that have passed between Southcott and Bartrop. They have held that Joanna Southcott's box was still around, passed down from custodian to custodian, that it contains important prophecies, the ones she locked up in there. But they've built up this whole mythos around it that, first of all, these prophecies will need to be brought forth at a time when Britain is in a national crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So you would occasionally see, like at the time of the Crimea or the First World War, you would see these kind of spiritualists saying, you know what we need now? Who's got the box?
Was the box sealed or were people reading from it the whole time?
The box is still sealed.
Sealed.
As Joanna Southcott left it. And in fact, its whereabouts and its provenance appear to be pretty murky at this point.
Oh.
So you've got multiple people claiming, you know, if you guys want the box, I have the box.
I've got the box.
But Southcott apparently in this version left behind very specific injunctions that it can only be opened by a convocation of 24, no fewer than 24 Church of England bishops. You need to get 24 bishops of the Church of England together, and they need to spend days in study and prayer and debate to spiritually prepare themselves for what will happen when they open these prophecies.
But the Church of England never wanted anything to do with Joanna Southcott, I imagine.
No, obviously not. You know, they would have regarded her as a mad woman at best, right, and a charlatan at worst. And so despite the fact that in the woo circles of of Victorian England, there are constantly cries, you know, like, look at what's going on in the Crimea. Look at what's going on in Africa. Where are the prophecies? And the panacea people in the 20s leap on this idea that there is this box.
And it has the answers.
And it has the answers. Now, in 1927... a Mr. Harry Price, at the time you would have known him as one of these famous debunkers, like a Houdini-like figure who's always going to seances and exposing charlatans. We talked about this in the Amazing Randy entry. He's the debunker of what he calls the National Laboratory of Psychical Research.
Uh-huh.
And he claims that a mysterious anonymous donor, a Mr. FM, has donated to his psychic research endeavor something he picked up from a Welsh family. It is a small walnut casket with two rusty steel bands that is, in fact,
the box.
The box of Joanna Southcott. Sought after for a century.
How did this Welsh family come up?
Exactly.
I see.
Exactly. But this is what he announces to the press when he holds this big event on July 11th, 1927 at Westminster's Church Hall and tells everybody, I am going to open the box. And
but who debunks the debunker? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
He's the debunker, but how do I...
Well, it's almost a century later and we can debunk him a bit because it's clear that he's a showman here.
Yeah.
And in fact, he was criticized at the time for being, you know, kind of as much of a showman in the name of skepticism as any of the charlatans were in the name of profit. He tries to observe Southcott's injunctions, but in fact, there is no real crisis to the British Empire in 1927 that he can claim to be addressing. He sends out 24 invitations to the bishops of the Church of England, and 23 say no. The Bishop of Grantham apparently is... in town, you know, has a place in town or something and agrees to show up. And so he has one bishop there to say, look, we did it.
But he's as good as 23.
And he's got, exactly. I mean, that bishop is 24 bishops in one. He's like a special case cereal. He's got this 12-inch walnut casket with the rusty steel bands around it. And he asks, you know, to make this part of his endeavor of psychic debunking, he has all of Britain's most prominent mediums or media, perhaps,
media.
The mass mediums, he has them predict what will be in the box using their powers.
This is Al Capone's vault.
He is not playing fair in the way that Geraldo Rivera would have. He has already X-rayed the box.
X-rayed it?
He knows what the answer is, yes. Oh. The thing about being in 1927 is you have the Curies and you have X-rays, and he knows what's there. So when he breaks the bands and opens it on stage... he knows that all of the mediums were wrong. And in fact, he knows what's in there is...
an iron bar.
Amusing and underwhelming. It has a dice... it's just junk. It's a dice box, a pair of earrings, an old-timey sleeping cap, a horse pistol, a rusty horse pistol, which my reading tells me has a weird holster that will let it hang over the pommel of a saddle.
Oh, okay.
It's a
horse pistol.
It's not for shooting horses, and it's also not for horses to shoot.
Horse pistol sounds like the name of an Americana band. Hey, we're horse pistol.
These all just sound like things that are lying around Sherlock Holmes's apartment.
Yes.
You know, Watson is like, Holmes, again with the sleeping cap and the horse pistol? Your faculties must indeed be bored.
Dice box.
There's also the dice box again, Holmes. My goodness.
If I were a horny footman, I would ask to be called Dice Box.
That would be like your cool nickname?
It's like a cool pistolerian, you know, like... maybe Dice Box would be my my name if I were a rogue or a scoundrel.
Don't you think it sounds too contemporary? I feel like Dice Box is giving information to Starsky and Hutch.
Oh,
hey, Dice Box.
Hey, Dice Box.
Right? Isn't Dice Box a cool guy in the most pimpin' outfit?
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't know. There's also just some coins. There's junk, basically. There is junk store, thrift store junk in it. And, of course, the popular press loves this. You know, ha-ha, for centuries... you know, and all this lady left behind was a bunch of junk.
But there's nothing connecting in the box to her?
The provenance is very sketchy, and in fact, everybody knows it. The Panacea Society is up in arms. There are protesters outside the hall saying, this box is a fake. And they say, we have a box. This is when the Panacea Society announces that we are the keepers of Joanna Southcott's legacy, and we've got it under a bed.
We've got a box under the bed.
And in fact, it's clear that Harry Price knew, if not that his box was fake and sketchy, at least that there are other claimants. He wrote a letter, in fact, to the Panacea Society saying, the Council of the National Laboratory are of the opinion that this will be a good opportunity of disposing of all existing Joanna Southcott boxes, and they therefore extend a cordial invitation to your association to have the so-called Great Box opened at the same time.
He's, wow.
he's like, we know this, but I know this one's lame, and I know yours might have a better claim. Bring it on in. We'll do a whole thing, you know. And of course, the Panacea Society is not having it. Boy, it's hard to say Panacea Society.
It is Panacea Society. That's the type of thing that would normally hang me up.
Do you think they should have gone with Panaceity?
Panaceity? Panaceity.
But the Panacea Society says no, and they hate the bad PR they get because they've still got the good box. And for decades, they spend the rest of the 20th century trying to hold a conclave. Because, you know, every time there's some crisis in Britain, you know, coal miners strike or a landslide in Wales, you know, any episode of The Crown happens, basically. Big smog. Any episode of The Crown happens, they take out ads in the Daily Mail saying, they have a thing, you know, they put up billboards. Crime and banditry, distress and perplexity will increase unless the bishops open Joanna Southcott's box.
When was that published?
These kind of billboards appear constantly up through the 1970s.
No.
Yeah, the Daily Mail, when they have free ad space, they will call the Panaceans and be like, hey, I know Margaret Thatcher's already prime minister, and it's surprisingly recent, but
open the box.
But will you buy an ad? And they'll be like, sure, if you give us a good rate. So it kind of became a joke in British society. And the premise of these ads is, when will those cowardly bishops finally get together and open the box? We have the box. We'd love to open it. We know these prophecies are needed.
But if you open the box without the bishops, what happens?
You got to have the bishops.
Well, what happens if you don't have the bishops?
I assume it's like crossing the streams. Maybe the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man appears, or it's like opening the Ark, probably.
Right, and it's just a bunch of sand, but then you dig in the sand, act disappointed, and then the sand burns out your eyeballs.
Mabel Bartrop, when he opens the Ark, close your eyes.
Don't look at it.
Don't look at the Ark, Mabel. This kind of becomes a joke in British society, that these constant barrage of war, disease, crime, and banditry will be on the rise. You know, it's a time of declining Britain. You know, this resonates. When will the bishops open the box?
Britain has such a much better set of inner jokes. Like,
right.
Jokes that only they get.
Well, America had to make this stuff up with National Treasure movies in an attempt at getting the same kind of mythology that, you know, Britain's got a king that'll rise again. They got a box that'll open. They've got it all.
Somebody said to me the other day that people in Europe think 100 miles is a long way, and people in America think 100 years is a long time. Yeah,
I like that one.
It's pretty good.
It's pretty good. The Panacea Society has a pretty successful 20th century. They're able to buy up a ton of – they basically have a campus in the city of Bedford where they're increasingly – you know, where they're devoted but increasingly elderly base of believers – have dormitories with places for all 24 bishops to sleep when this eventually happens.
Could solve the housing crisis in Bedford right there.
This is their bunker. Like, they are ready for the end times because they've got 24 beds for the bishops, and they build, you know, in their belief system, Bedford is the site of the Garden of Eden, of course.
Right. Right. Having been there, I can confirm.
It does make sense, right? That it would be somewhere near Cambridgeshire,
uh-huh.
I guess. Yeah. They have built a whole house that is all ready for Jesus when he comes.
Jesus famously wanted a nice house.
In Bedford. I mean, so many religious traditions are like, you know, we're ready for you, Jesus. You know, but how many televangelists have built him a nice three-bedroom house?
Well, what they've done is build themselves a nice 15-bedroom house. One of them is
when
for Jesus
comes, he can stay over the garage. We're we're all ready for him.
It's across the hall from my room, so we can talk all night.
And they claim to still have the box in a secret, undisclosed location, ready to open whenever the cowardly bishops are ready and when Britain needs it.
And are there no competing boxes still?
I think the other traditions have mostly died out. It was just a series of elderly ladies were able to keep this one going into the 21st century. I believe the last... I mean, there are other traditions. I think there's a rumor that in 1966, one was sent to the British Museum, who actually opened it and copied out the stuff for the British Library.
Oh.
Both institutions deny this happening, as they would, of course.
Sure, of course.
There's another line of thought that Shiloh was reborn. This is like a Princess Diana era mythology, that the Shiloh was finally reborn in the form of Prince William. You know, that he's the prince that was promised.
He's awful cute.
He's a cutie, and that's the main thing that the Bible agrees about Jesus.
Jesus is going to be cute AF. That
the teens are going to love him.
So this does feel like a episode of British Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah.
Like that someone would
Someone's going to show up with the box.
Like, hey, I found this box, but I can't open it.
So to this day, the Panaceans claim that they have custody of the box. The problem is that they are no longer the Panacean Society. The last Ruth Klein, the last elderly one, having died a few decades ago.
What? Who inherited the stuff?
The Jesus House?
Yeah.
The place has been converted into a charitable trust in 2012.
Boring.
And the campus has been turned into a museum where you can come read about... I mean, it's the same. You know, you go to a Shaker Farm and they're still selling furniture.
Right.
You go to Bedford and the Panaceans are still there selling the box. Uh-huh. They have it. They say they have it hidden away, but what they have is kind of a replica version on display.
Yeah.
As kind of a local curio. What a fun bit of local history.
Maybe
your gran would have seen these ads and billboards
behind closed doors.
They claim, as far as I can tell, you know, when the Guardian or somebody writes about the story, they say the Panacea Charitable Trust still holds the box and is just waiting on. It's like the ERA. If we can get 24 bishops on the same page, we're still waiting on Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio, and we can open the box.
And that concludes Joanna Southcott's box. Entry 673.GN4910. Certificate number 49596 in the omnibus. Futurelings, social media is long gone. All of social media was put into a box.
And locked up.
Locked up and cannot be opened until 20 of your octopus bishops all agree to let the demon out. It is not a happy Jesus baby in there. No, it is the worst Willy Wonka acid trip you ever went on.
I think the Timothée Chalamet version of Wonka is a much more, it signals a switching in Christianity. You know, no more do we have the foreboding, cryptic, trickster Jesus of Gene Wilder. Now we have kind of a wide-eyed Bambi Jesus.
Yeah, he's really Bambi Jesus. I did go to see that one, that movie.
Did you go to Cinerama?
No, I have not been to the new Cinerama. But I'm waiting to go to see Lawrence of Arabia with you at the Cinerama, which is...
I talked to Tom Marr, and they said they're going to bring back the 70mm stuff, and they're going to do all six Tolkien movies in February.
I would go see that.
I'd go see the first three. I'm not going to see The Hobbit.
Oh, those are included in the canon?
Yeah, when I say all six, I think it's a series of nights.
But I feel
so
like...
You don't have to sit for 18 hours.
Did I just see something that said that now there are extended cuts of the three Tolkien movies where they're like 3 hours and 45 minutes long each?
Those have always been on DVD or Blu-ray.
Oh, they were
on home video, and they're at least half an hour longer.
Have you watched them?
I have.
Do they have extra dragons?
They still have no Tom Bombadil. I regret to announce.
Come on. When does Tom Bombadil get his own movie?
Even with an extra hour.
The ring doesn't work on him.
AI Mickey Rooney will play Tom Bombadil in 2060.
But in Asian face.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No, I don't think so.
Anyway, you can go to @OmnibusProject, @KenJennings, @JohnRoderick. You can't, really. I mean, when was the last time you posted on Twitter?
Never.
Or X. No, you have done it before. I've seen you there.
I think if a friend will be like, hey, will you promote this on Twitter? I'll be like, sure.
Oh, right.
But, you know, like Jeopardy and Sony are not on Twitter, I noticed. Like, ooh. I don't know if it was corporate-wide, but... Take
Makes
that,
sense.
Elon.
Yeah, take that if you were looking for Sony news.
If you wanted to see somebody promoting the new season of For All Mankind, guess what? You're not going to see it on Twitter.
But you can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com, and we will get your mail, and also we will often reply to it on our Patreon-only addenda show. We do one a month where we read your mail and then give lengthy replies where we often debunk your misunderstandings. But if you are actually correct, we will mea culpa and take your criticism, and both Ken and I will apologize.
We never say we're wrong on this show. You have to pay us money to hear that we're wrong.
Yeah. And we won't really admit we're wrong. We'll hem and haw about it.
Oh, you know what we should add at this point, John?
What's that?
Is that the Patreon tiers just got even better.
I am so excited about this. We had a long conversation about it today, and I was like, well, we should only give this benefit to people at the $29 level or higher. And you were like, no.
What about the common man, John?
I want everyone who donates to the Patreon to get this incredible benefit. Why don't you tell them about the benefit, Ken?
Here's the new benefit. If you give to Omnibus at the merest $5 level, not only would you get the...
not only are you super basic.
No, you're not super basic.
Well, I guess you're, I guess people that don't give are super basic.
Yeah. You love the show more than the vast majority of our listeners if you give it the $5 level. Not only will you get the monthly addenda show, but...
wait for it.
Beginning this week, we are rolling out our show ad-free 2 days early.
Think about that.
48 hours in advance on Tuesday, not Thursday.
You get the show on Tuesday and no ads. $5 a month.
We're ramping up the ads a bit, ad sales a bit. So
that's right. There are going to be more ads coming,
and we're making them worse. We want to punish people who don't give it this level.
We went through a long period, which is to say, for almost the entire run of the show, where our ad sales team sometimes would get lost in the snow, and sometimes would die of digitalis poisoning.
They'd forget the password to their laptop, so they couldn't sell ads for us, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that happened a lot. But now we have a reputable team of people from Englang who are going to be putting some ads in the show. So this $5 pledge, membership in the Patreon.
Level of support is going
to get you the show 2 days earlier and without all this rigmarole.
Do you miss when Omnibus was on Tuesday? For you, now it is. It's back.
Do you want to hear Ken and me do ad reads for CBD oil and penile enhancement drugs?
Thursday people do. That's what you get for free. Anyway, we hope that this makes supporting the show by Patreon an even better value proposition. Go to patreon.com/omnibusproject to find out more.
That's patreon.com/omnibusproject. You can hang out with other futurelings by putting the word futureling into your web browser, into Bing, or whatever web browser you prefer. And futurelings, in their many forms, their many splendors, will turn up. You can support the show at Patreon. As I said, that's patreon.com/omnibusproject. We encourage you to do so. And you can send us real mail to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Sounds like you've got a little bit of a mailbag over there.
Well, we have, even though we're recording this well into 2024, in our timeline, it's about a month into the new year. Apparently, I didn't go to the P.O. Box for a while.
You've been busy.
So all the people who were delighted that we now acknowledge Christmas cards on the air, send us a late Christmas card, which we are just now getting to.
Speed read.
Here's the Mumfords.
Hi, Mumfords.
Here's...
Merry Christmas.
Here's the Laubies, L-A-U-B-E, Lobs. I don't know.
Hello.
This one has a robot who made a pie for us.
Oh, I like that.
But the punchline is, I learned this from my grandma. She was a pie tin.
I don't know. Yeah. Do pie tins make pies?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few problems there.
And
would a robot's grandma be a pie tin? Are we imagining that a robot's grandma can be any metal object?
We're talking about recycling now.
The
robot sees the DNA of a pie tin in itself, but it is a higher form.
I mean, if robots reproduce at the same generational rate we do,
yeah.
Like this robot's grandmother is probably from the, early 20th century.
Yeah.
When there were no robots.
Probably.
But there were pie tins.
Probably the pie sat on someone's windowsill cooling, and a hobo came along with a bindle, and... I'm not sure how that would end up being a part of a robot.
Here's one from Sonia and her dogs, who saw 10 movies at the theater.
Is it Sonia with a J or a Y?
A Y. There's an I. You go J or Y? There's more I's than J's and Y's in America. Maybe not Y's.
Sonia, S-O-N-I-A?
Yeah.
What? Really?
There's more I's than J's.
I seems like a Finnish spelling.
I think the J is the Finnish, no? Is J German?
You're the Finnish.
I have no idea. You're the Finnish spelling. 100% Wordle rate. Good job, Sonia.
Nice, well done.
Two dead presidents visited.
Which two?
Yeah, I don't know. Is she implying she's going to kill Jimmy Carter? The Donahues have a Taylor Swift-themed card. Did they go to the show? Unclear.
Handsome family.
Yes. Josh and Rissy and their cat say, our shitter's full of Christmas cheer. But there's no, you'd think the picture would be a toilet pun, but it's not. It's just a picture of them with a Christmas tree and a pool noodle.
Our shitter's full
of dot, 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 of Christmas cheer.
Is there anywhere in the picture? Is there a little Basque pooping?
Oh, is that, Christmas it could ornament? Be the cagador or whatever. No, I guess you just have to know them to know about their hilarious catchphrase.
Guess so. Our is full, and then every holiday they're like, it's full of something else.
Classic Josh and Rissy.
Our is full with Easter tidings.
Like if they come late to the party, they're like, the is full of tacos, and they've got a bag of Mexican food. The Harju family updates us on celebrating a wedding anniversary at the Wisconsin State Fair.
And also it's a holiday card.
Yes, but you know how it's like end of the year. It's like it's like the family Christmas letter. Here's what we did this year.
Because the state fair is always in September.
The Shranks wish us many goods and cheese.
Thank you, Shrank family.
I'm reading through their update. One of them made a quilt. Ooh, Pacific Crest Trail. That's a good hike.
That is a nice one.
The Cheryls appear pretty Mormon.
Cheryl.
S H E R R I L L. I feel like they've written before.
Are they Utah Mormon or they must Idaho be. Mormon?
Well, there's a picture of them welcoming home a missionary. That usually happens at the Salt Lake Airport more than at others.
Right. Is there like a whole like terminal at the Salt Lake Airport?
Have you ever done that?
No.
You walk out. It's the only place in the world that still looks like Love Actually. Because you walk out of the Salt Lake Airport terminal at the right time of day, and there's 10 people holding banners, you know, welcome home, elder, whatever, welcome home, sister, whatever.
Oh, no, that's so cool.
And people bring, you know, the family comes from as far away as, say, Mesa, Arizona.
Right. To the Salt Lake Airport.
Preston, Idaho. All the way.
Is it because when you return, you go to the temple for some kind of, like...
No, there's really no... It's just they haven't seen them for... Right. It's really like a... You know, coming home from the army is the closest analog,
I think, in
secular life. Thank you for all your holiday greetings that we are belatedly getting to. We also got this cryptic one. It's addressed both to you and your daughter, name spelled incorrectly, but...
Yeah, that's fine.
But we'll live with that.
You know, it happens.
And it's apparently an invitation to the Secret Order of the Sticker, the world's foremost secret society concerning sticker art.
Ooh.
They have decided to allot to this individual, presumably your daughter, one Secret Society member Jumbo Secret Sticker Pack, or SSMJSSP. And it is an enormous overflowing...
Well, let me see the certificate. That seems like suitable for framing. Oh. That did not get to me.
Not even.
The secret... But it's got like a Masonic symbol.
It is the Secret Order. And then just a bumper... Oh my gosh, they're spilling all over. So many stickers, pizza stickers,
whoa,
musical notes. Here's pond animals.
Whoa.
Here's cute animals. Here's letters. Here's road signs from around the world. These are beautiful. I didn't know stickers were still a thing.
Oh, they're a thing. All right. Let me see those stickers. She's going to lose her mind.
Oh, because of scrapbooking, right? Adults are now buying this stuff.
Oh, wow. There are a lot of stickers here.
All the 80s kids that had the Punky Brewster stickers, I just realized, are now... scrapbooking moms who are still buying them.
Holy frijoles.
Look at all this.
This is bonkers.
And there's also Japanese erasers shaped like dinosaurs and eggs, but possibly not dinosaur eggs.
I feel like I have not done enough in this life to have deserved this bounty of things.
Well, that's the thing. You were not a great dad, maybe, but guess what? Now you are, because you can deliver this from iStickwell.
Wow, I feel like they opened Joanna's box, and this is what fell out.
Oh, here's Japanese penguin eraser, possibly? Figurine?
This is... What a bounty. There is an eraser that looks like a hard-boiled egg.
How many stickers would you say are there? Like, just off the top of your head.
Hundreds. Hundreds and hundreds.
It might be 1,000 stickers.
I mean, there's 1,000 stickers here. This package right here... has 112 pieces.
Oh, well, that's the thing. Yeah.
Each individual sticker.
Could it be five figures? Could there be...
No. 10,000 stickers?
But there are thousands. Yeah. There are thousands.
There are so many. And they're great because some of them are like puffy.
Yep.
Some of these are actually pads of stickers.
And will your kid enjoy these? These are going to be turning
out,
up
world.
On... The walls are going to be covered with these.
I know. I have to explain, you know, I think we got rid of her desk recently because we got her a new desk and it was an old IKEA kid desk. But she'd made the classic sticker error of putting a bunch of stickers on a thing that you can't take with you.
Yeah.
And so she was like, but my stickers. And it's like, yes, darling.
It's a good. That's how kids learn about death.
Stickers come and go.
Sometimes you put a sticker down and you can't pick it back up.
And she said, "What do you do?" And I showed her my toolbox, and I said, "I put stickers on my toolbox because I'm always going to have my toolbox."
You know, my kids' equivalent of that is their water bottles. They put stickers on their water bottles because you're always going to have your water bottle.
Some of these are crazy. You're always going to have your water bottle until your water bottle gets grotty. I mean, the more grotty your toolbox is, the better.
I think the same is true of water bottles.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
With young people, they're just like, my water bottle's
really
gross.
Really gross-looking water bottle. Thank you so much. Thrilled. I don't know who the real I Stick Well is because I don't think there's an actual cover letter, but thank you so much for the admission to the secret society of sticker files.
Well, you know, a friend of mine, who's also a friend of this show, was clearing out his house, and he had, you know, boxes and boxes, archival boxes of graphic novels. And he was gonna get rid of them all because he's of this new school where it's like, this stuff isn't worth anything.
It doesn't spark joy.
All these things cost $24 at the time, and now they're just not worth anything. And he said, "I want to give them to you, but a lot of them have adult themes." And I said, "Well, why don't you go through and take the ones that have adult themes out and just pick the ones that have strong female leads?" And so he went, can't believe he did it, but he went through and he gave me a whole banker's box of graphic novels that don't have any nudity and have strong female protagonists.
The girl boss box.
And he gave it to me and was like, "You know, I hope that she loves these." And what I have done is I have hidden the box. And every once in a while, I give her one. And so she thinks,
does her chores.
I never connect it to like, if you do this, you get a book. It's just what it's developing in her is this feeling that her dad, in his going about the world, is remembering her and bringing home these like mysteriously chosen. How, like, I think the biggest confusion for her is like, how am I choosing? Right.
You're such a good curator of children's comics, John. Yeah, who knew?
But they're not children's, you know. They're like young adult stuff. They're sophisticated themes.
You're like the anti Joanna Southcott. You have a box full of Wonder Woman comics, and you're not telling anybody.
But I am bringing them out without any bishops. And the person that gave them to me has no idea that I have used this gift to turn myself into a greater, like, larger mystery for
but
my
didn't
kid.
You say they listen to the show?
Yeah, so I'm outing myself, but you know, the show won't be out until March. So
you got a couple months. I should also, we have so much mail. Jeremy also sent us these giant cans of Old Bay seasoning in hopes that we will cover more Maryland material on our show.
Old Bay seasoning. So do you ever make seafood at home? Don't you?
Yeah, yeah. And I like Old Bay. You know what? Have you ever had the Old Bay fries at the ball game?
Yes.
At that little crab shack over in right field.
Yes.
I
don't like French fries, but I've had Old Bay.
They do put Old Bay on the crab sandwich.
Yeah.
Well, look at these. I didn't know they made Old Bay this size. Look at this.
That's incredible.
It's bigger than a can of soda.
Does it say you can put it on things other than crab?
It says poultry, salads, or meat. But can you imagine just pouring this on a steak? I don't know.
I guess. I mean, how much MSG is in it?
It is 100% MSG. No, actually, it's still very simple. Salt, celery seed. Oh, I think spices maybe can include MSG.
Spices.
But all they're owning up to is red pepper, black pepper, and paprika.
Huh. It works.
Maybe that's all they have.
I love the smell of it.
Do you think this is what's keeping us from more Chesapeake Bay material on the show, is that we were waiting for a bribe of two giant canisters of Old Bay seasoning?
I know for sure between the two of us, we could do 5 hours just on the Chesapeake Bay.
I do like products that still look like they did in 1920, though.
Yeah, that is such a great can.
And there's not that many. Maybe Morton Salt and Old Bay seasoning. Thank you so much, Jeremy. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.